Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Find out about new shows, featured guests, and what's up this week. Find us on Facebook by searching keyword Voice America.
The Institute for Self-Reliant Agriculture is making changes and valuable contributions to the health and well-being of the less developed world around us. Join founder Michael Bumstead today on Growing People from the Ground Up. Michael, his co-host Tom Rockwood, and guest speakers will show you what's being done now and how you can help.
Well, we welcome you to Growing People from the Ground Up, a show that we talk about a program that the Institute for Self-Reliant Agriculture does throughout the developing world, as well as a little bit here at home, to help people become self-sufficient. Today, we are not going to talk in detail about our program right up front, because that'll come out during the show. But just in summary, our program helps the rural farmers and developing countries to become self-sufficient, to be able to feed the family nutritionally. Nutrition is our focus. But today's show, we are taking a little bit different focus. We're talking about food security. Now, this is a subject that would affect everybody in the world, including the developed world. So today's show, we have two guests on that will be talking about food storage as well as seed storage. Seed storage would be an important element to add to your food security to be able to have the ability to grow food, obviously. So today's show is for all those who are interested in improving their family's food security through seed storage and food storage. Again, our show, though, is always for those who are interested in being involved in a program that helps people become self-sufficient. So you always have the invitation to become involved with our program. Tom, are you prepared for Christmas?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's the rush time of year, the last week before Christmas, so I thought maybe because of the guests that we've had the last few weeks, we've been given a few last-minute gift ideas that might work out well for our listeners. For those that have been able to listen to us as we talk about becoming self-reliant, both in third-world countries and here at home, one of the things that we focused on is gardening and the benefits of gardening. And gardening, of course, is America's favorite hobby. And even though it's hard to think of gardening this time of year for most of us who live in at least the northern part of the U.S., it's still a great idea for last-minute Christmas gifts. Anything from gloves. I know if you're like me, I think I have 6 left-handed gardening gloves in my garden pail. And for some reason, we just can't keep a dozen, a pair. So anyway, things like pruning implements. Some people like garden chimes. I love the idea of maybe buying some children-sized tools to get your kids out in the garden. We've had guests talk about the benefits of that. One of the things that can get us excited for a spring is maybe buy some houseplants that are transplantable. And one of the things that's popular right now, if you have seen it, are the live rosemary bushes. They look like they're trimmed to look like Christmas trees, and you get to enjoy both the herb and the wonderful smell and aroma in your home, and then you can transplant them in the spring.
Well, bulbs, that's a neat of course, idea. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it is. And bulbs, of course, are always popular. It's nice to watch those germinate in the home, whether that's the big amaryllis bulb, or now they've got some that will grow in water so your children can see the miracle of plant growth. And then, of course, last-minute ideas. You can always get a gift certificate to the local home center, or there's gift certificates for seeds and even plants. If you've got a person in your family that would love to have an apple tree or a peach tree, and now's not the time, you can always buy them a gift certificate. And then there's great books. We've had many of your guests, Mike, have actually written books on things like square foot gardening, rotation gardening. All of that is readily available and perfect gift. One final thing I thought I'd mention is some years ago, I knew a couple. They were semi-retired, and I asked this friend of mine what he got his wife for Christmas. And he said, well, you know, this year we decided to do something different. Now, this was 20 years ago. And he said, we decided that our Christmas budget for each other was going to be $600. And that's a pretty hefty present, but they had some means. And I did some math, and that would be worth about $1,000 each today. And they decided that rather than go out and buy each other's $600 gifts, they were going to donate each of them that $600 to the other person's favorite charity. And I thought, you know, what a neat thing to be sitting at home on Christmas and knowing that you meant something to somebody else instead of each other. They had given each other their love and their life, and to be able to decide to demonstrate their love for each other by doing that, I thought was terrific. Now, having remembered that story, it got me thinking. Some weeks ago, we shared a few ideas on how we can shorten or decrease our carbon footprint. You might have remembered when we had the author of Earthships, and it was very interesting. So we shared a few ideas, and one of the ideas had to do with Christmas, and it suggested that maybe we look at sharing some e-cards or internet cards instead of the old-fashioned paper cards. And I talked to my wife about that, and we decided, as much as maybe some neighbors might think it's a little tacky, we decided that was what we were going to do. So we designed an e-card that we're going to send out. That way we're going to save on the energy it takes to deliver a card, the energy and natural resources it takes to produce cards. And then we decided, of course, it would save us money on postage as well. And we decided in our own little way, not only were we going to do the e-card and try to lower our carbon footprint, but we would donate all the money, including the postage we would have normally paid for, to SRA. And I know that's a small donation, but it's just one little thing we decided we could do at this Christmas time to maybe share with those that are less fortunate. So there are some last-minute Christmas ideas there for you, Mike, that you or maybe some of our listeners might be interested in using.
Well, thank you, Tom, for those ideas. Also, both of our guests will probably have Christmas list ideas for our guests as well. Today, we have a couple of very interesting guests. The first guest, Diane Ott Whaley. She's the co-founder of Seed Savers Exchange, a very large non-governmental seed bank. In fact, I believe it's the largest non-governmental seed bank in North America, with the goal of making varieties available to the public, seed varieties. Diane, are you with us today?
I am. Good morning.
And it's an honor.
Good afternoon.
In Iowa, I guess, isn't it? You're in Iowa?
We are.
Are you ready for Christmas back there in Iowa? Is it snow on the ground, cold?
No, you know, that's the common question. Everybody assumes we have snow, but we don't. We don't have a white Christmas so far, but we're all hopeful. We should.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Well, that's great. Well, it's an honor for you to be on this program. I know you have a very large following, and you, over the last few decades, you have developed a very large organization. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your background and how the Seed Savers Exchange came to be.
Okay. Well, my background is, I think I was sort of groomed to be a seed saver or a homesteader or one that likes to control my food, because I grew up in a home where we were self-sufficient. My grandparents raised 9 children during the Depression, and my grandmother I always was amazed at this. Her grocery list was sugar, flour, coffee, vinegar, and spices, and everything else they raised from their farm. So I was very definitely aware of how to be self-sufficient. And gardening, of course, was part of that, and visiting my grandparents as a child and visiting their farm and realizing that everything that their family needed was produced from their hands and from their land. So it was very powerful for me to be seeing that as a child, and then growing into adulthood, realizing that many people are wanting the same thing, but there's been a generation between where a lot of these skills have been lost, and being self-sufficient and seed saving is certainly a skill that was part of everyone's life around the turn of the century. And of course now it isn't part of life and isn't even part of someone's garden. So we're trying to bring this back into popularity. It's not it's been with us for a while. I mean, actually, all the food that we have today is here because of our past generations being able to save and pass seed on to the new generation. So Seed Savers Exchange began with that concept, actually with my grandparents' seed, when we had our first garden and asked my grandfather for the seed of the morning glory and a tomato that I always associated with their garden. He mentioned to us that the seed was brought over to America with his parents when they immigrated. And I had never known that story, and suddenly I felt, you know, connected to this family that I'd never thought about, never met in a distant land. So with that handful of seeds, and later that winter, he passed away, and Kent Whaley and I realized how important having that handful of seeds, because if he hadn't given us that seed, it would have been lost when he passed away.
What year was that, Diane?
That was in 1972.
Wow, okay.
And then, so we started realizing, you know, how often that might happen, and with the introduction at that time, the gardeners and farmers were more interested in the hybrid seeds, because that seemed to be, you know, the newer, better way to garden. So a lot of the old-fashioned or heirloom varieties of seed that came into this country when people immigrated were being lost. And so we decided to start Seed Savers as a nonprofit organization with our mission to save North America's diverse but endangered garden seed varieties for future generations. So from that day on, we started slow with a handful of seeds, two varieties, of just sharing seeds and plants, and also educating people about the value of genetic and cultural diversity associated with the plants.
Okay. So that is a fascinating story. So you started off very small, and it's
right.
grown into be very something very large now.
It
okay,
is. It's with
What is the mission of Seed Savers Exchange?
Well, I think, as I said, to collect and conserve and distribute heirloom varieties of fruits, vegetables, flowers, and herbs. But we also want to educate people about the value of the genetic and cultural diversity in the seed. You know, because we... it's one, when you talk about controlling your food or asking where your food comes from, you know, seeds, that's the beginning of it all. And sometimes I think that's overlooked because you want healthy-looking produce and beautiful produce, but it's all responsible, all here because of the seed. So we, you know, as a nonprofit organization, we've been able to collect and maintain you know, many accessions of seed in our collection. So I feel like that's our mission these days is to is to save and preserve these varieties before they're lost.
Diane, this all sounds very interesting, but I wonder how you're getting your message across. What's the most effective way to let people know of your wonderful organization?
Mm-hmm. Well, I like the voice. The human voice is one way. So we have many different ways that we have speakers that go out. Probably to keep up with the times, the internet has been a great way to reach people. We found that at first we started out with just mail, you know, the old-fashioned way, mailing letters, and our members would mail letters to each other. And that worked, you know, that's a great way to start a grassroots organization is just people networking together. And as that has changed over the years, we found that, you know, we can reach a lot of people through the internet. And plus, having really beautiful, healthy seeds available to the American gardening public has brought so many people to us because everyone's looking for safe heirloom seed, and we can provide that, and safe in many different ways. I mean, number one, it's certified organic, and the other is that you can then become, you know, more self-sufficient by starting with productive seed. So I think a lot of people have been finding us these days because of just that very thing. People are really concerned about where their food comes from.
You know, you have started off with two seeds, and mm-hmm. you have all the varieties you have now with the education and everything going on. How does it make you feel to be part of an important movement like this? Did you ever envision that it would grow into something that Seed Savers is today?
No. I mean, we had always hoped that it would become larger than when we started. But, I mean, as co-founder of a nonprofit organization, your dream is for it to live beyond your time in your involvement. And, you know, it happened very slowly, and now it's been escalating in the last 10 years. But when we started, we were just so focused on keeping the mission and keeping our focus and just keeping up with what all that involved. I mean, we had members, we had gardens to grow, we had 5 children. We started this nonprofit, just the two of us. And so we were very involved with just the day-to-day activities of just keeping the organization viable. And I think one day it was kind of a realization. We realized, you know, we have really grown and how wonderful it is because, you know, it's the people who actually carry the seed preservation on. And we have a seed collection, and we will always have a viable seed collection where we're preserving our seed. But really, to have the seed grown again in people's gardens and the stories that go with the seeds, you know, bring the seeds to life. So it's been, you know, it's a whole nother level of gardening, and we're so glad that so many people joined us over the years. We have, you know, close to 13,000 members now. We send out our catalog to lots of gardeners throughout the country. So definitely, we started when heirloom was not popular, and even the word was not commonly used as it is today. And here we are in 2012, set to go into our next chapter, which will be, you know, really educating more people and getting more people involved with our work.
Well, it's a great story, and we need to take a break right now. We'll continue this discussion with Diane Ott-Whately in just a few minutes with Growing People from the Ground Up.
This is the Voice America Green Living Channel. Spread the green.
In a world where parents struggle to feed their own children, the Institute for Self-Reliant Agriculture is dedicated to teaching families how to grow, what to eat, and how to become self-sufficient. By giving people the right tools to grow their food, we're not just growing crops, we are growing people. Your host, Michael Bumstead, president of Self-Reliant Agriculture, shares stories of struggle, success, and perseverance that families and communities experience in South America and other parts of the world on the weekly internet radio program, Growing People from the Ground Up. Through the Institute for Self-Reliant Agriculture's See the Change program, you can select a family to sponsor and, with frequent updates, watch as they progress towards achieving goals to provide for themselves and feed their families. The work Self-Reliant Agriculture does today impacts individuals' lives tomorrow. Please visit us at www.selfrelientagriculture.org to read about recent projects, see videos, and view photos of families and the communities where they live. That's selfrelientagriculture.org.
Learn how to become a part of the solution, not the problem. Participate in the discussion by calling 1-888-346-9141. That's toll-free 1-888-346-9141. This is the Voice America Green Living Channel. Spread the green.
You're tuned in to Growing People from the Ground Up with your host, Michael Bumstead, and his roster of special guests and weekly contributors. To find out more about the Self-Reliant Agriculture Program, or if you have a question or comment that we can address on a future program, please send an email to comments@selfrelientagriculture.org. Now, back to this week's program.
Well, we welcome you back with Diane Ott-Whately, the co-founder of Seed Savers Exchange. Diane, I have a question for you. I need to get out there because I don't know the answer to this myself. Okay. What is the most important part of seed storage? What elements do we need, you know, as far as climate and moisture and all those type of things? I don't know how to sow seeds.
Okay. Well, as I say so often, our ancestors stored seed, you know, quite easily without any information, or they just had good examples. But the backyard gardener, it's the important thing is a steady temperature and keeping the seed dry and cool. So we suggest the backyard gardener just put dry seeds down and store them in a jar in a cool place. And I think that probably a consistent temperature and one that's going to provide cool and dry conditions. In our seed conditions here, because of Seed Savers, we have thousands of varieties of seed that we're storing. So we mainly store it in our storage facility that's 40 degrees. And the key is never to have the humidity equal higher than 100. So if it's 40 degrees, and you don't want it to be more than 50 to 60% humidity. So
okay.
So cool and dry, really.
Do you have to dry the seeds prior to storing them?
We do, and so would everyone. That's very important to dry the seed. We just let most of our seed air dry to begin with, and that probably is sufficient for most gardeners. But then we take it a step further and have drying rooms where we actually monitor the drying process as well. But if the seed is dry to the touch, and like a tomato seed, if you can break the seeds apart, it's probably ready to be put in the jar for storage.
And how long would a seed be good for when you store it in that condition?
In that condition, I would say it depends upon the seed, but maybe 5 years. But and what would happen is that the germination would go down each year. It wouldn't probably die in 1 year if these conditions were met, but the germination might go down a little bit from year to year. We monitor our seed at 5 years. We check and do a germination test. But most gardeners will want to grow the seed, from every year. They choose what they want to save and probably want to grow it again the next year or so.
Okay.
That's great information. Diane, you also wrote a book entitled Gathering. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, Gathering is the history of Seed Savers, and I mainly wanted to write the book to summarize a little bit what we've talked about earlier, is how we started with an idea and a handful of seed and a dream, and just two people with that goal in mind and reaching our goal as where we are today. I thought the process needed to be written because so many people who join our organization today, and certainly our staff, we have 60 people working for us now. When we started, we had two. And, I think it's really important to put the culture of our nonprofit and the history into the organization. And so it gives a personality. It's the story of Seed Savers, is we preserve the stories of all of our seeds. So this is the story of how our organization grew. And it was a great opportunity to acknowledge all the people who have helped us over the years.
Anyone who watches the Food Network knows a lot about heirloom tomatoes,
yes,
because that seems to be quite the interesting ingredient to make salads. That word heirloom, when it's referred to food, always interested me. Can you tell me a little bit about the heirloom movement?
Sure. That is very interesting to us, too, because when we first started this 35 years ago, it wasn't in the common language, and now it's in Hollywood movies, and the kids are all right. Annette Bening said, if I hear heirloom tomato one more time, I'm going to throw up, So I thought, wow, heirloom tomato in a Hollywood movie. We've really, made it. But an heirloom variety is an open pollinator variety, and that means that it will come true year to year from seed. So when you are trying to be self-sufficient, it is a really important part of your life is to have open pollinated or heirloom varieties of seed, because you can save that seed from year to year, which only increases your self-sufficiency. But an open pollinated is a seed that that will come back from year to year just by saving the seed. Heirloom varieties are open pollinated varieties, but they also have a history of being cultivated and saved within a family or a group. So it's like a piece of heirloom furniture or jewelry that's been valued by a family and then passed down to the next generation, except this is a living heirloom. So,
okay.
And, yeah.
That concept right there is very important to our program in developing countries.
Right.
We try to get these small farmers. Imagine a small farmer with an acre and a half, something like that, and he's trying to feed his family on that. Mm-hmm. There is no way he can compete with a large ag business. He can't get enough monetary return to feed his family. So we take them out of that model. We take them out of the market is what we do. Mm-hmm. And we teach them to grow all the food that they need to feed their family, and that's the first focus they have. One of those steps in that process to get them full self-sufficient, just like you explained, was to have them have the ability to continually use their seed for the next production. Mm-hmm. So this heirloom concept is extremely important mm-hmm. for our little farmers in developing countries to become self-sufficient. It's a concept we use in our program.
Yeah, well, that's great. And we at Seed Savers, we have a book called Seed to Seed that is a good source book on how to save the seeds for each particular variety. It's something, again, that, you know, it's been lost in our culture because my grandparents did it. And that was part of their, you know, their harvest was not only the vegetables but the seed. And, you know, they always kept potatoes, for instance, for the next year's garden. The nicer ones had a special place in their storage in their basement. I remember that's where the seed potatoes were. So, I mean, it's very important. The seed is really such an important part of being self-sufficient and controlling your food source.
Now, Diane, the last chapter of your book is entitled "The Rooster Step."
Yeah.
What does that actually mean?
Well, and it's so appropriate now because we're approaching the season. My grandmother would always say after the first day of winter, the days would get a rooster step longer. And as a child, I thought I never quite understood what that meant, but as an adult, now I do. And what she was trying to say was that the change of the day is so small that you wouldn't be able to really measure it, but maybe after a month, you know, it might stay light for maybe half an hour longer, and then certainly by the first day of summer, it was like 1,000 rooster steps longer. So I think it always felt important to me to really realize that some of these steps that we take are, you don't, when you ask, were we surprised at the result? We didn't even notice it, actually, because we were so busy just doing what we needed to do. But at the end of the day, we had an organization that is beyond any of our wildest dreams in a place here in Iowa called Heritage Farm, where we, you know, we grow and save seeds, and we have a family of people here as well. And it's the moral of the story, I think, is small things add up to be major accomplishments. And yeah. Everyone has the power to do it. I think that's the other thing, is that everyone can do a small thing, and it would add up. And I think, so my grandmother was right. Just...
Yeah, it's very, you do a great service there to save these seeds and also to get other people involved in this generational gap that we have that you
mm-hmm.
explained.
Mm-hmm.
Want to be sure that people know how to get in touch with
sure.
you. How do they do that before we run out of time?
Right. We have a website, www.seedsavers.org. You could also, and that would give you all the information. If you don't have access to that, you can call 563-382-5990. And we have a catalog that we send out that would be full of Christmas holiday ideas because we do transplants and seeds and memberships and, you know, so it's a very useful gift for people who are interested in gardening. And
That's
a beautiful fun. Gift too.
That's wonderful. We've got just a minute or two left. What would you like to share with the audience?
Well, I think just welcoming them to join Seed Savers, because we're more than a seed saving group. I think we're a family, and we like to encourage and welcome anyone into our group and be there as a resource for them. Education is really important. Because that's the key to really understanding what we're trying to save at Seed Savers. So I just would like to welcome anyone who has any interest at all in gardening and saving seed or just gardening to contact us.
Great. We have about 1 minute left. Would you like to tell us about your Heritage Farm very
sure.
quickly?
Sure, yeah.
You're talking about a big family. That is one
yeah.
big family right there, isn't it?
It's the home place for our big family. We put together this wonderful farm in Northeast Iowa. It's 860 acres, and We're preserving the landscape and our as well as garden seeds here because, you know, we rely on insects for pollination and bees certainly for pollination. So Heritage Farm is the headquarters for Seed Savers, but we're preserving streams and limestone bluffs and white pines, and the farm really is a living museum of historic vegetables and flowers, herbs, cattle. We welcome people. We're open, 9 months out of the year. And again, you know, when we talk about genetic diversity and the beauty that we're trying to preserve, when visitors can walk through our gardens and see the tomatoes in every color, there's red and green, purple, pink, black, you know, striped, and then they understand diversity and what we're trying to save. So it's really nice to have a living history farm here.
Wonderful. If I ever get back to Iowa, I will give you a visit, Diane.
It's been a pleasure
to have you on our show, and I hope people contact you to carry on this work.
Thank you.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have Jason Budge with a food storage company to talk about food storage. Well, stay with us. We'll be right back on Growing People from the Ground Up.
Listening to the Voice America Green Living Channel for the latest in the sustainability and green movement for all of our futures today and tomorrow. The Voice America Green Living Channel. Spread the green.
In a world where parents struggle to feed their own children, the Institute for Self-Reliant Agriculture is dedicated to teaching families how to grow, what to eat, and how to become self-sufficient. By giving people the right tools to grow their food, we're not just growing crops. We are growing people. Your host, Michael Bumstead, president of Self-Reliant Agriculture, shares stories of struggle, success, and perseverance that families and communities experience in South America and other parts of the world on the weekly internet radio program, Growing People from the Ground Up. Through the Institute for Self-Reliant Agriculture's See the Change program, you can select a family to sponsor and, with frequent updates, watch as they progress towards achieving goals to provide for themselves and feed their families. The work Self-Reliant Agriculture does today impacts individuals' lives tomorrow. Please visit us at www.selfrelientagriculture.org to read about recent projects, see videos, and view photos of families and the communities where they live. That's selfrelientagriculture.org.
This is the Voice America Green Living Channel, helping to promote a sustainable future for us all.
You're tuned in to Growing People from the Ground Up with your host, Michael Bumstead, and his roster of special guests and weekly contributors. To find out more about the Self-Reliant Agriculture Program, or if you have a question or comment that we can address on a future program, please send an email to comments@selfrelientagriculture.org. Now, back to this week's program.
Well, we welcome you back to Growing People from the Ground Up. This last half hour, we are going to share this time with Jason Budge. He's a co-founder of Shelf Reliance, which is an emergency preparedness and food storage company. And Jason, we're going to have to be a little careful here on the Shelf Reliance and Self-Reliance concept. They're pretty close, but they're different companies, are they not?
Yeah, they are. And we actually kind of started our company with that concept in mind, that we want to help people become self-reliant. So hence the company name Shelf Reliance has a little bit of play on words there.
Yes, it does. You actually sell a couple of different products. You sell a product that rotates the cans on your shelf so that they always stay fresh. It says, problem has been on my shelf. You know, the ones in the back kind of get forgotten about. But also you sell a food storage product that's dried foods.
That's right. The company kind of got started. We felt like there was a real need to prepare our own families, Steve Palmer and I. And so we developed a shelving system that really helps people rotate their food. It was really kind of a way for us to build a small supply of food in our own home and keep it rotated. And so you drop the can in the top, and it rolls around to the back and comes back to the front, kind of a first-in, first-out concept called a food rotation system. And that's kind of how we got started, and then later on we really felt there was a need. We could help people become more prepared for future events by also providing a longer-term food product called Thrive Foods, and we have about 135 different dehydrated or freeze-dried items that have a substantial shelf life to help people build up a long-term food supply.
I have both of those products in my garage at this point. Where I'm just putting your shelving rotational system in now, but I've had both of the food, you know, the freeze-dried foods as well as now your shelving material that rotates the cans. But it's a very easy way to go, and I would encourage people to do that if they have the money. But I want to put the audience at ease also for those who do not have the funds to buy these products. We still have concepts on food storage that we want to share with you. And it's the concepts of food storage that we want to concentrate on during this half hour. Jason, a question for you. What in the back of your mind got you started in the food storage industry? Was there something underlying desire that you wanted to help people in this concept?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mike, and I appreciate what you said. We really are all about helping people become self-reliant, self-sufficient, and prepared for the future. We have some great products to get us there, but there, the underlying concept is what's most important, that people get prepared. We really felt, my wife and I, and also my business partner and his wife, we really felt there was a need to prepare our family. You know, there are a lot of unforeseen events that happen in one's life, and we really wanted to be prepared. We didn't want to be left in a situation where we could not provide for the needs of our own family and our children. And so really this company, this concept, it came about because we wanted to get prepared, and more importantly, or as importantly, we wanted to help other people get prepared. We felt like there was a real need to educate people on the importance of having a long-term supply of food and understanding how to use and rotate that so that they, too, can be prepared in times of need.
I'm glad he mentioned times of need, because most of us, when we think of food storage, we're thinking what a tremendous asset that would be in times of disaster. But there's other things that cause need for being prepared as far as our food goes when it comes to economy and jobs. Maybe you could touch on that.
You know, Tom, that's a great point, because I think we typically think of the earthquake or the tsunami or the tornado, and surely those are important needs to be prepared for. I think the more common thing we see is we see people having a need to turn to a supply of food in those kind of everyday things that happen to our families, those local tragedies of job loss or accident or illness, disability. There are a lot of things that happen in life that we can't forecast. And when those times come, we've seen a lot of people be able to turn to their food storage for a period of months, even years, and be able to rely upon that to provide for the needs of their family. And so I think probably the more significant thing people ought to be considering is, I need to have something on hand that if those typical, everyday, sometimes tragedies occur in our life, we can turn to a supply of food and we can meet the needs of our family and be able to get by.
Well, Jason, let's start talking about nuts and bolts then. How does a person get started in food storage?
Well, you know, it is a concept that I think a lot of people, perhaps most people, aren't familiar with. So I think, generally speaking, it doesn't have to be complicated. People ought to start by storing what they eat and eating what they store. We like to encourage people to start off by building a supply of food, maybe with a goal in mind of getting up to 3 months worth of food. If you are a big Top Ramen eater, then buy a few extra packages of Top Ramen when you go shopping. When you see things on sale, buy a few more of those so you're building up a supply of food. If you eat SpaghettiOs or beans or what have you, then those are the things you ought to be starting with on storage. You know, my family, we have five little kids. We go through cold cereal like it's going out of style. And so we have... You know, we have 70 to 80 boxes of cold cereal that we rotate through. And as we kind of deplete that little cereal storage, we'll go and buy more cereal. So I think the key is to start storing a little bit more of the things that you're used to eating that are typical to your family. Once you've done that, and you really want to have a good, solid supply of food, there are a lot of other things that I think are wise to have on hand that have a longer shelf life that allow you to do more things over time. some of your grains, wheats, those type of things, sugar, salt, some of the basics that if you had to go for a longer period of time, you could actually have some of those basics that have really a substantial shelf life.
It probably is important to have some kind of labeling system, isn't it? If you're storing all those boxes of cereal, that type of thing, how do you know what when you bought all that material?
You know, it's a great point. The rotation aspect is really critical with all this. You know, it's not uncommon for us to hear people who come in and say, "Hey, I pulled out a can of beans that had the date 1976 on it," you know, because it was stuck in the back and they weren't able to access it. So when you're considering a food storage, you really need to be thinking through the organizational aspect of this type of a system. How are you going to organize it, and how are you going to rotate through it? There's lots of creative ways to do that. I've seen people put in between the studs in their garage, the exposed studs, I've seen them put little boards on a diagonal slope and kind of line their cans up so that they can pull out the bottom and put in the top. Really clever idea. I've seen people have different labeling systems where they mark the actual date that the food was purchased and they make sure and inventory it. Or simply finding a way on the shelf to kind of slide foods from one side to the next or from front to back, back to front. I think there's a lot of ways that we can get creative and do that. But if you don't think through a way to organize and rotate that food, it does get a little more complicated to avoid some of the wastage that can accompany having larger supplies of food on hand.
Those are great ideas, but I wonder how much food should a person store?
Well, there's you got to look at your situation and your needs. I look at it this way: if something were to happen and I didn't have access to a grocery store because there was a disaster, and that's we hear stories about this all the time. Or if I were unemployed for a year, or if I had become disabled, you know, how long do you want to have security? If you're looking at retiring from a job, how long do you want to live off your retirement? And I think that's maybe the way to approach food storage. I'll tell you just a rule of thumb. I think if people start with a 3-month supply of food, that's a tangible goal. That's something people can achieve. Give it 6 or 12 months, and you can build up a supply of a 3-month supply of food. But ultimately, I think the goal ought to be able to sustain your family for ideally a year, and not just your family. Think of it. If something were to happen, you're going to have probably other people coming to you. If you have a food supply that you want to also support, neighbors, friends, family. And so a year supply of food really gives you the autonomy of taking care of your family and also reaching out to some of those others who might be in need and helping them out as well.
Right. You know, the concept of food storage is not always common throughout the undeveloped world. I know that comes to a shock when we're talking about people that live or die on the amount of food that they can grow for themselves. There is no governmental system that feeds them or anything like that. They survive on what they grow on a little plot of land. And let me tell you a story real quick, if I can, just before I break here, on Perca, Peru. I was there a year and a half, 2 years ago. Little village up in the hills above Cusco, Peru. And we were looking at this village as a potential site for our project. And the people were storing food in their rafters. And I looked up, and these houses were tiny little mud huts with grass roofs. And I looked up in the ceiling, and here's a corn cob with corn on it. And then right next to that is a little piece of meat. And the mice were running up and down the rafters of that roof. And that's the way they store their food. It's not much of a concept that works for them. And it's a concept that's surprised me that we have to teach these people how to store food, take the corn off the cob, dry it, and put it in a container and those type of things. It's a concept that surprised me that we have to teach that to our people in our villages. What else do you have as far as fresh produce? How much food should they have as far as things that are not freeze-dried? You mentioned
well,
3 months.
If you're looking at fruits and vegetables, I think we're all pretty familiar with the shelf life of a tomato or a banana. You know, we kind of keep those on hand as we need. If something were to happen where you needed to turn to a food storage supply, you'd have a week or two of your fresh produce. But we also have, you know, the other extreme, of course, is going with freeze-dried foods, which have typically a 20 to 30-year shelf life. And that's the other extreme. But if you're talking about just your daily foods, if you're looking at a can of beans, a can of SpaghettiOs, a can of peaches, you know, you're going to have typically a 6 to 12-month shelf life on that. And so if you were to store 3 to 6 months of just those typical foods that you eat that have a shelf life of that amount of time, then I think that's a great way to start. And then you can supplement that with some of these longer-term foods thereafter, some of your wheats and your barleys and your grains and your long-term dried milk, things like that, that really have a long shelf life, freeze-dried fruits and vegetables.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here in about 30 seconds. But when you come back, Jason, why don't you think about this in preparation for the audience of doing all of this on a limited budget. You talked about it's important for people just to get started for whatever situation they're in. You go and buy one can of food, we'll buy two. And put one on the shelf and you consume the other, but get started. But so if you can come up with some suggestions on how to do this with a budget, that would be very helpful to our audience. We'll take a short break now.
I'd be happy to.
Okay, that'd be great. And we'll take a short break now and stay with us. This is Growing People from the Ground Up.
This is the Voice America Green Living Channel. Spread the green.
In a world where parents struggle to feed their own children, the Institute for Self-Reliant Agriculture is dedicated to teaching families how to grow, what to eat, and how to become self-sufficient. By giving people the right tools to grow their food, we're not just growing crops, we are growing people. Your host, Michael Bumstead, president of Self-Reliant Agriculture, shares stories of struggle, success, and perseverance that families and communities experience in South America and other parts of the world on the weekly internet radio program, Growing People from the Ground Up. Through the Institute for Self-Reliant Agriculture's See the Change program, you can select a family to sponsor and, with frequent updates, watch as they progress towards achieving goals to provide for themselves and feed their families. The work Self-Reliant Agriculture does today impacts individuals' lives tomorrow. Please visit us at www.selfrelientagriculture.org to read about recent projects, see videos, and view photos of families and the communities where they live. That's selfrelientagriculture.org.
This is the Voice America Green Living Channel, helping to provide a sustainable future for us all.
You're tuned in to Growing People from the Ground Up with your host, Michael Bumstead, and his roster of special guests and weekly contributors. To find out more about the Self-Reliant Agriculture Program, or if you have a question or comment that we can address on a future program, please send an email to comments@selfrelientagriculture.org. Now, back to this week's program.
Well, welcome back to Growing People from the Ground Up with Jason Budge, co-founder of Shelf Reliance, an emergency preparedness and food storage company. Just prior to the break, we were talking about some of the important elements of food storage. And Jason, you're going to share with us some of your ideas on how a person can do this on a limited budget.
Well, Mike, that's probably one of the main questions that people ought to be asking is how do they afford having extra supply of food? I think probably the most important thing is that when this becomes a shift of their perspective, when people see this as a priority, they're going to find out that they can afford this a lot easier than they would maybe imagine. When you go to the store and go shopping, and you see a number of sales, typically you're buying right now, people are buying for their family for a week or two. And so they may come across beans and see those on sale and buy those for a week or two, and then they're buying other things that aren't typically on sale. If you get in the mindset of saying, I want to build up a supply of food to really protect my family and secure our future, then when you go to the grocery store and you see those beans on sale, you're going to pick up a few extra cans of beans at that lower price. When you see a few other items on sale, you're going to pick those up as well at that lower price. When you're constantly in this mindset, what's going to happen is pretty soon you'll be eating foods in your home that you purchased at a lot cheaper price. I really feel that if you get when people get into the idea and concept of storing food, that they actually save money over time just because they're used to looking for those good deals in the store. I think that's one way to really help see how you can afford having a food storage on a maybe a smaller or limited budget. Also, there's a lot of people that get into couponing. I think that's a great concept. can obviously save a lot of money. The third thing I think is really important to realize, and we really promote this at Shelf Reliance, we help people build a home store. We help people see the importance of building a supply of food in their home that they can go shop from. When you are constantly going down and using the foods from your supply of food, from your home store, if you will, you're less likely to make as many trips to the grocery store, which, as we all know, when, the more trips we make, we typically buy more things that we weren't planning. We buy, you never go into the grocery store to get a gallon of milk and walk out with a gallon of milk. You walk out with Oreos and crackers and cookies and whatever else you might pick up, but we typically impulse buy. When people have a supply of food in their home,
for me, Jason,
they're
going to
typically save money just because they shop from their home store more frequently.
Right.
That makes all the sense in the world. What about storage conditions? We all live in different parts of the country. Some might find extra space in their basement. Are there dangers storing food in different locations, whether it has to do with heat or moisture?
You know, the three enemies to shelf life are light, temperature, and oxygen, and also moisture. And so I think when we look at conditions to store food in, really, if you've got an area that you can keep the temperature at 70 degrees or lower, and there aren't a lot of high fluctuations in heat, maybe even a darker area so there's less light that can come in and break down those food conditions, then those are kind of the optimal conditions. So stable temperature, 70 degrees or below is ideal, cooler conditions, lower light, and if you've got a place that you can reduce the humidity, that's ideal as well.
That's great advice. How about a person that's living in an apartment? What can they do?
I've seen people get really creative with where they store their food. In fact, I've got a sister-in-law who made the choice after she got married. She had a particular space that she said, I've got room right here for a TV, or I could put my shelf of food right here. And if other, it was kind of one or the other. She chose, for her it was a priority, to have a supply of food, and so they kind of put the TV somewhere else. I think you can get creative. I think there's lots of places that perhaps behind furniture. I've seen lots of people use space under their beds. If it's a priority, people will find a place to store the food.
You know, you made a comment before I want to get back to about our fresh produce, you know, the bananas and the lettuce and that type of thing. I know that I end up throwing quite a bit of that away because I buy too much and then I don't eat it before it spoils. The one advantage of freeze-dried food is you don't have that, correct?
Freeze-dried food will last typically 20 to 30 years. The great thing about it, because of the process, it's an all-natural preservation process, no additives or preservatives. But because of the process, it actually maintains the shelf life of these foods for an extraordinarily long time and doesn't actually break down the nutritional value. So a freeze-dried strawberry is going to have more nutrition than a dehydrated strawberry. And it maintains the same structure. So, yeah, there are a lot of benefits of having freeze-dried foods as part of your long-term storage.
How do people get in touch with you, Jason?
Well, we have probably the easiest way is to come onto our website, shelfreliance.com, and they can see some of the things that we offer and see what we're about. And that's probably the easiest way to contact us.
Okay. I'm proud to tell our audience that your corporation is a corporate sponsor of our program down in Ecuador. And we have a few minutes left on this show. Why don't you tell us about, you have about 3 minutes max. Why don't you tell us about your experience that you and a couple of your partners had in Ecuador in visiting our villages?
Well, Mike, I wish I had 20 minutes. I've got lots to share. I've been so impressed. We took a trip down there this fall. I wanted to see what was happening with our partnership with Self-Reliant Agriculture and couldn't believe the things that were happening for good for people. Looking at these wonderful Ecuadorian people, very humble, very kind and generous, living destitutely in many situations and still finding happiness. There were a lot of situations that touched my heart, but one in particular that I think was really moving. We went and visited a school, an elementary school up in a high mountain village in Ecuador. And beautiful kids, beautiful Ecuadorian children, just uh, just a year or two prior to Self-Reliant Agriculture implementing this program, helping them become more nutritionally self-sufficient, these children were they were on the brink of starvation in many situations. Very lethargic, not learning like they should. Their bodies were malnourished. They just didn't have what they needed to grow and become thriving children. After having the program implemented where Self-Reliant Agriculture came in and really helped these families understand how to provide for themselves, how to grow a more effective crop, how to provide better nutrition for their family, these kids had a huge change in their life. The teachers, what was funny to me is the teachers were really surprised that these kids all of a sudden had all this energy. They were so lethargic before, and now they were bouncing off the walls like we know young kids to do here in America. And they were just full of life, full of vitality, just because they had more proper nutrition. They had more purpose and zeal in life. We actually went out and played a little bit of soccer with these kids, and they were just about better than we were as little elementary kids. Tons of energy. In fact, the thing that was impressive most to us is that these little kids' soccer team actually, over the last couple of years, had gone on to win lots of their regional soccer tournaments. They became kind of the superstars because they had lots of energy. They had lots of a much healthier condition they were living in. So
Jason,
we were really
Jason,
touched
I,
and moved
I saw
by
the
this
village.
Group
I know the village
families.
You're talking about, but did you get in and see all the trophies that they had? That from all those soccer leagues that they played in?
We did. It was amazing.
couldn't
believe it. And they were so excited. I mean, you talk about life-changing. They had purpose and meaning in life now, and they felt accomplished for what they'd done. We absolutely loved it. We just were amazed at what this organization, SRA, is doing for people in Ecuador and around the world.
Well, thank you. I wish we had another 20 minutes to talk about this, but we have to close for today. Great show. I appreciate you being on here, Jason, and sharing your concept about food storage. Next
thank you very
week,
much.
We
good
have
to,
two.
Good to be with you.
Thank you very much. We have two very interesting guests next week. John Renard, he's a designer of a well drilling machine that drills wells without electricity. We'll share that technology with you next week, as well as Trudy Davidoff, who is the co-founder of the Winter Sowing Germination. We'll show you how to sow seeds right in December, right on Long Island, New York. Until next week, have a good weekend. Have a Merry Christmas, and we'll see you next week on Growing People from the Ground Up.
Thank you for tuning in to Growing People from the Ground Up. Please join your host, Michael Bumstead, co-host Tom Rockwood, and their guests next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time, on the Voice America Green Living Channel. We'll talk again next week.